Welcome to Real Paranormal Activity, the network. Entertainment you'll enjoy.
You are listening to an RPA production, where people gather. LaFoss Corporation, LLC.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show, Dave Emmons' Strange Reality. And I have another, I guess, a very experienced person on tonight or today or in the morning, whenever you watch this show. It's pre-recorded. I just also want to remind you, I got a buddy, Aaron Hunter, who's a producer with realparanormalactivity.com. That's realparanormalactivity.com. And he reruns my shows on a Thursday night. So if you want to see or you missed any of my shows, go to the Thursday night on realparanormalactivity.com and you'll see my shows that he has. I guess he has a segment on it. I don't know if it's 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, but just go to that website, www.realparanormalactivity.com. And this show, Strange Reality, we're on, I guess, a couple of times a week. And have a lot of interesting guests. And I like everybody out there. And I also like the people who don't believe, but I like everybody out there that's open-minded and their consciousness is high and they watch the show and they kind of give me the views. And I appreciate that. That's great. I appreciate my people that follow and like the show. My guest this evening, and this is a guy that I just found on the Facebook. And I saw his resume and what he's done. And he's had some really good experiences working with people. And he's shouldered up to a lot of big names. He'll talk to you about that. Bud Hopkins, one of my heroes in this ufology. We're talking to John Carpenter. And he's been interested in UFO since he was in the fifth grade. He's got a BA in psychology, a master in psychiatric social work, 44 years experience providing psychological therapy. And he's just the man, I guess, that MUFON was interested in too. And his training in hypnosis led to writing MUFON, Bud Hopkins, C-U-F-O-S. And you call that CUFOs. Abduction hypnotherapy research from 1989 to 2000. Director of Abductions Research of MUFON 1991, 2000. And you must know Kathy Martin. She was on my show about 3 weeks ago. Yeah. And he spoke at conferences in England, Scotland, Brazil, Chile, Australia, Canada, Mexico, and Netherlands, plus all over the U.S. Made presentations for Bob Bigelow's NIDS, NIDS Science Panel, 1995. And he's got 6 books, and we're going to talk about each one of them as a talking point. And John Carpenter, welcome to The Strange Reality. And you want to add to what you're doing now or what you think about what's happened in the past with you? It's all your, the floor is yours, John.
All right. Well, thank you, Dave. Well, yeah, I mean, I remember, my gosh, I think it was Donald Kehoe, a book that he wrote, and I actually tried to read it in the third grade because I was realizing that he was talking about flying saucers. And of course, the third grader finds that pretty cool, except that he was telling it like newspaper accounts, like it's real. Mm-hmm. And that blew me away. I got really excited. And this is about the mid 60s now. And by 1965, a lot of things started happening. They had the UFO flap in Michigan and they had all sorts of things coming on the news, and it was becoming a more interesting subject. So I always kind of followed it. I remember when I actually have the Look magazine where Betty and Barney Hill's article first appeared in 1961. Right. So yeah. That's probably worth something now. Yeah. And when Travis Walton had his experience in 1973, I was graduating from high school, and He and I are not too far apart in age, and I've met him and known him. But at the time, I ended up writing a research paper for an English class in high school, and the teacher was so impressed with the information in it that she gave it an A plus and kept it as a model for other people to learn how to write research papers. I had no idea that I was going to go on to actually do UFO research, but yeah, I think it
and
was starting to show.
Write 6+ books, actually. The teacher was right. You know, she knew you were a writer, even when you didn't know it.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, when I went to college then, there was a speaker there on UFOs, and I decided, I'll go listen to him. J. Allen Hynek.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And he's very short. I went up to him afterwards and I said, I'd like your autograph. Just a simple autograph. And he goes, that's the only kind I know, a simple autograph. But it was really cool to realize later who I'd really met, and that I was already starting to meet significant people. Well, make a long story short, in the mid-1980s, Missing Time and Intruders came out with Bud Hopkins, and of course, Whitley Strieber's Communion, and they're all like between about 81 and 89, those books came out. Well, I'd been trained in hypnosis at the Menninger Clinic in Kansas in 1980, as part of my career as a psychiatric therapist. So here I'm reading these books where they're using hypnotherapy to explore UFO abductions, which is now a whole new thing. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I love this stuff, and I know how to do hypnosis. So I thought, nah, and I waited a whole nother year.
Yeah.
Now, a year later, I decided to write to, in the back of Bud Hopkins' book, he had MUFON, he had KUFOS, which was Hynek's organization in Evanston, Illinois, and and Bud Hopkins, his address. And so I wrote letters to all three. 2 days later, Walt Andrus of MUFON calls me and says, we're signing you up. You're going to be a state section director in your area over 4 counters. You're going to be a research specialist with your hypnosis talents. And we are delighted to have a professional working with us. And I said, okay.
Yeah, you got a field commission like an officer. You went right
on. I did.
Yeah.
And then I didn't hear from KUFOS, which who knows why, but because they did talk to me later. But 2 months later, Bud Hopkins calls and he says, I'm sorry it took so long, but it takes me, I'm 2 months behind on opening my mail, which I can certainly understand. Mm-hmm. He gets a lot of letters.
Right.
But he talks to me on my home phone for an hour, going over hypnosis things he's done, tricks and different things he's used, and talking about my techniques. And we just shared like two professionals. And then he referred me a case in Missouri, where I live, and I was off and running. And he taught me one thing, which I really loved in doing the hypnosis, because, you know, many skeptics will say, with hypnosis, you're just suggesting the answers to them, and you're leading them on, and of course they're going to see whatever you suggest that they're going to see.
Right. That's what I was going to ask you about a while ago when you were talking about hypnosis. I was going to ask you to explain it and how you actually do your hypnosis and how real it is, and without planting a seed.
Absolutely. I'll give you some really good examples. And I did this relentlessly. I mean, I'll explain what I did. Knowing full well that they could be suggestible or they could take something off of what I might say, I was very different. I might say, well, what happens next? Or what changes in this scene? Or what's the next thing you notice? You know, basic general questions like that. But then I used trick questions, and Bud had used some of these, and then I really developed it after he gave me a couple examples he uses. I really went into it. Paradoxical questioning, and here's an example.
Okay.
They're taken somewhere. They don't know where they are. And I said, well, they're in some room with a bright light. And I says, well, look around the room and tell me what you see in each of the corners of the room. And you see their eyes going round and round and round. And then they apologize and say, I'm sorry, it doesn't seem to have corners. It appears to be a round room. Well, I knew it was a round room, but it's logical to assume that every room has corners.
Yeah.
And they never, ever fell for that question. They'd go, I'm sorry, it doesn't seem to have any corners. It's a round room. So I'm forcing them to come up with a different answer. Not at all what I was suggesting, but going against my suggestion to actually bring out the information. Mm-hmm. I'll give you another quick example too. This is a double layer, two tricks in one question. I'll say, well, this thing or creature that you're seeing now, what do you hear a high, medium, or low pitched voice when he opens his mouth? And they look and they look and they look and they go, well, first of all, it doesn't seem to ever open his mouth. And I don't hear any tone of voice. It's like their thoughts are in my head.
Right.
And of course, I knew that they never open their mouth. Mm-hmm. I also knew that they never hear a tone of voice. But I'm suggesting a very logical question. When they open their mouth, do you hear a high, low, or medium pitched voice? There's nothing strange about my question.
Right.
But if you've had a UFO experience, it's a very strange question because that's not what they experience.
Right. I've had experiences, and the questions you're asking, those are great. I never heard a hypnotist talk about it that way. I went to a hypnotist one time. It didn't work. It backfired. She went out as the hypnotist. She went out at the desk, and I had to go wake her up because it's hard for me to go out, John. I mean, how does one actually settle down enough, I guess, to be succumbed by hypnosis, John? How do you do that? How do you get them relaxed?
Well, first of all, we get you nice and relaxed. And I use my hypnosis voice, very nice and relaxed. And you're breathing and feeling all your muscles in your body relaxed. Now, stay with me now.
Okay. Okay. I'll pass out here at the mic. Yeah. Okay.
But anyway, I'll deeply relax them. And there's clues I can see when they're really out of it and relaxed. And then I'll go to their last conscious memory. They might have 2 hours of missing time and really not a clue of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just take them back to like, okay, you're driving a car and what changes in the scene? How has the scene changed? And they go, oh, I'm pulling over. I didn't remember that. I says, well, what do you hear? Well, the tires are coming to a stop and it's really quiet outside. And they'll say, well, do you smell anything? Do you hear anything? You know, I'll just ask basic questions and they don't have to. But and usually I can get another detail forward. And as soon as they get another detail forward, then I use that to take another inch forward. And then all of a sudden it may just open up
mm-hmm.
where they remember a whole bunch of things flooding into their mind. And my specialty kind of was to take people kind of like Betty and Barney Hill, where you have two or more witnesses.
Right.
And to hypnotize them separately, not let them talk to each other. And, to see what happens, what they come up with. And wow, I had a great case. It was on the front of MUFON Journal and it was well talked about. It was in the KUFOS Science Journal. Two women traveling back from Colorado and they both saw a bright light in the sky. They pulled over and then they saw it coming down into the field and then they don't remember anything. 2 hours later, they're driving off. They feel irritable. One's nose is bleeding. They don't understand what's happened. They hate science fiction. They could care less about UFOs, but they knew something was wrong. And luckily, thanks to the MUFON state director in Missouri, when they got back to St. Louis, he heard about their case and someone told him, you know, reported it to him. And I happened to be in St. Louis that weekend. And so I got to deal with the first one 1 week after it happened, which is like unbelievable that I would be able to start that quickly.
Mm-hmm.
She knew nothing about UFOs, never seen any alien drawings or nothing. And just in short, she came up with so much research that we haven't even shared with the public. And she knew so many things. And when I finally got to her friend a week or two later, she too remembered the same details. But it's interesting because the second one was on a table being examined and something put up her nose, and she's the one that had the nosebleed. The other one remembers standing there being forced just to watch and not being able to move to intervene. The one on the table remembers her standing and watching. The one watching remembers her being on the table. Everything matched up beautifully. Mm-hmm. And again, neither one of them knew anything about this subject. When I showed them a picture from Bud Hopkins' book, they both just fell over. They go, you mean other people have seen this? And they were just stunned. I mean, those moments make your whole career. When you,
John, did they describe to you the ETs themselves?
Oh, yeah. Typical gray with big black eyes and, you know, skinny bodies and four long fingers, you know, very typical alien. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, when people get screen imageries, we call, where they think they see a big white owl instead,
mm-hmm.
I'll say, well, tell me about his feathers. And when they look closely, they go, oh, it doesn't seem to have any feathers. Oh, well, tell me about his beak. Well, no, it doesn't seem to have any nose. Well, tell me about his claws. No, they look more like four long fingers. And then they go, wait a minute, that's not an owl.
That's
I get to break.
Yeah, that was that case in Washington State where they had the owls in the fourth kind, I believe it was called.
Yeah.
Now Bud Hopkins and of course,
by the way, I'll tell you real quick. I had 4 foot hamsters, 4 foot gerbils, 4 foot bunnies, 4 foot owls, 4 foot.
Really?
You know, yeah. I mean, everything was 4 feet tall, but not exactly alien at first look.
So, you're saying, John, that they screen, they can take your mind and screen different pictures in your mind?
Oh, yeah. And especially with children. They would tell children, oh, I'm just your favorite bunny, and, you know, playful figure. And children would think it was funny and cute, but they weren't allowed to really see the image of what they really look like, at least until I come along. And then I help them to uncover the projected image into their mind and see what they actually are looking at.
Right. John, can you determine the believability of these cases when they talk about bunny rabbits and 4 foot, squirrels or whatever they see? Can you decipher or determine what is real and what's not real, John?
Well, because so many other details are so UFO related, like seeing the craft or seeing, you know, the bright light or the beam of light or something like that. I know we're probably talking about aliens, but I let them go on with their image because sometimes it's safer to recall that image, at least to start with.
Mm-hmm.
But now and then I'll just throw in a thing like, oh, what's their furry paw doing now? And then they'll go, oh, it's not furry at all. You know, just kind of catch them off guard, and they take a really good look at what's going on, and they realize it's not that image that they were told, you know, to see.
Right. Most of us, I mean, most of us who's had encounters and we're contactees, experiencers, we have seen our own events and our own experiences. But there are people, I've interviewed a lot of people, and there are people who usually come from just a dream, a lucid dream type of event, and it doesn't appear to be tangible or real or physical. Can you explain the difference between like a cerebral dream, lucid dream, and something tangible that they're actually there?
Well, that's a good question. You know, a lot of times the dreams start happening after they've had an experience, even if they're not sure if they've had an experience. And so I take their dream images very seriously because they might just be dreams, but they also might be a cover for something that actually happened. Mm-hmm. So I'll do the same kind of investigation where I'll just have them, oh, tell me about the nose, tell me about the beak, tell me about the paws. And they can't do it because now when they look at it, they're starting to see the real thing. And if that was just a dream, I wouldn't get anywhere. You know, they said, oh, yeah, the paws are doing this and blah, 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 blah. And also their emotion. If the dream is upsetting or they're having some kind of anxious or almost like post-traumatic stress reaction, and that's a very important point because almost everyone that I dealt with had post-traumatic stress, which means they encountered something extraordinary that they don't normally experience. And they're haunted by it, and little things remind them of it, like the place they drove in the road, or an owl with big eyes. They now hate them. They can't stand to see them there. Or one person was putting two fried eggs in a skillet, and they saw the two big yellow eyes, and it freaked them out.
When you're having
PTSD reactions like that, it's significant that they're having an emotional reaction to something they don't remember.
Yeah. And also, I guess experiencers also have these bad habits of being hyper alert. They're always looking up. They see an airplane, they're watching it real close to make sure it's not a UFO. So it's a hyper alertness that I think I experience myself. And everything, when I first see it, it has to be ET related. But then when I study it a little bit further, in which I do, I've been a trained journalist, so I have ledgers and I have notes, and I take a better look at it later on. I say, okay, I know what that is. I know that happened. So I try to, you know, evaluate myself. I guess you run into people who do that too. A lot of people say, aren't you afraid? No, I said, I'm curious. I want to find out more. I want to find out what they want. What's going on with these ETs and why me? That question, I guess you get that too. These people are scared and they say, why me, John? Well, why?
I thought that I might make their lives worse by having them remember all this scary and unexplained, confusing stuff. But they often told me, no, now it explains why I react this way. Now it explains why I feel this way. Now it explains. One lady said, it's like there was a missing page in my book and you found it.
Yeah.
You know, and I always liked that when she said that. It made sense. And if I had them meet together in a group and talk about their experiences, they loved it because they could share with others and not feel so crazy or alone or different from everyone. They actually realized, hey, you know, a lot of people have this same kind of stuff happen and have the same paranoid or scary reactions. But let me say something else about people's reactions, because since I'm in psychology, this was real interesting.
I was going to go there. Yeah.
Imagine you send 100 people to a movie theater and they all see like Rambo 3, something like that. Now, do you think all 100 are going to come out and they just shared the same experience? They all saw the same things. Do you think all 100 are going to come out feeling the exact same way?
No,
because human experience means some people come out raving about it, saying it's the best movie ever. It's so cool. All this action. Another person says, I hated it. It was stupid. Another person says, it was scary. I couldn't watch it. Another person says, I was bored. I fell asleep. So I noticed with UFO experiences that some people come away feeling spiritually evolved. Mm-hmm. Some come away feeling traumatized and victimized. Others come away now hungry to learn more. Mm-hmm. And so I noticed that even though the same exact type of things might have happened in each of their experiences, it's who they are and their life experiences that shapes their reaction to it.
Right. I had a buddy that we saw something different. We saw a UFO up close. It was only about 35 feet off the ground. It was like a little round pudgy saucer. And he heard a humming or a sizzling sound. I didn't hear it because I was paying attention to the portals. And I saw the shadows walking across the windows in the midsection of the craft. And he said that he heard a sound. And I said, I didn't hear that sound. I was seeing shadows. I was watching more visual. And he was hearing, and I've never heard all my, I guess, the UFOs I've seen. Only one, the giant triangle that went over me, I heard a hissing, buzzing sound from it. But that's the only one. But you're right. We all see something or concentrate on something differently. And your psychology training background, John, how does that, you're cutting a thin line between psychology and I guess interpreting an experience, an ET experience and a dream or whatever. How does that mix in? How does that help? I know psychology does help you do this stuff, John.
Well, to me, it has basically been another form of post-traumatic stress disorder. The difference is, like if you're in the war, which I believe you were.
Yes, I was in a war.
Right. You know, it's the war.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with these people is they're having all the reactions and the symptoms, but they don't know what the original trauma was.
Right.
And it kind of relates to, I remember a person I worked with that they had a phobia of Christmas tree lights. And I thought, how in the world would you be afraid of Christmas tree lights? Well, it wasn't a UFO case, but it's an example of when I went back to help them see the Christmas tree lights, they noticed that they were on the floor looking up at the lights from underneath the tree. Well, I've done that. That's not a big deal.
Right.
Until I realized that there was a person on top of them and molesting them.
Oh,
now it's all different. And the reason why the lights have a negative thing is because they're paired with the bad experience.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good example of how you can have a reaction to something but not know what the trauma is. And in the missing time cases and UFO abductions, most of the time they had no idea. They know they saw something strange, or they lost time, or you know, something like that. And then with what I might recover, then they suddenly, it explains why they're reacting the way they are, why they can't go down that stretch of road, why they have these nightmares, why they have this going on. So to me, it's just another type of PTSD. And it makes sense because that's what a normal human reaction would be to something extraordinary and out of the ordinary.
Right.
It's just they don't remember what the event was.
Right. I've had those moments of lost time. Matter of fact, my buddy and I, that first UFO I saw, but actually second, but we had lost time, but we didn't know what went on. But I guess about a couple of years later, now you might want to tell me more about this because I've had regressed dreams. And they were like down the road some, and they finally come back to me in a dream. And I had a dream. I was on a table and my buddy was in the same room with me on board the ship. It was dark and it was warm and they got our shirts mixed up and I couldn't put the shirt on because I was a little chubby when I was younger. I still am, I guess, admittingly. Yeah. But we had the wrong shirts on. So we ended up with the right shirts and we ended up standing in the lot that we started from. But you can have regressed dreams from an event. What? How long later can it happen, John?
Oh, I lay 40 years later after her events. You know, no one had ever worked with her, and it was still hidden away inside of her. But she had some very questionable images and clues that she didn't understand. And I was amazed, but even though it was 40 years ago, she clearly remembered as we got into it. And that's the thing. If you've been traumatized by something like that, you do remember, but you're at a subconscious level, you're remembering. And that's why you react with the cues in the environment.
Now, in psychology and hypnosis, John, I know I was talking to you about cerebral dreams as compared to something physical and tangible that you go through and experience. I don't talk about this and I don't ask people about it. When I interview them, I give everybody the benefit of the doubt. I never tell anybody I don't believe them. That's a no-no. And I think MUFON has to be careful with that too. You know, going to people and stories, but don't act like, you know, okay, yeah, turn your head and nod, like say, roll your eyes. They see that and they think, okay, you know, they don't believe me, you know, so that interview is basically over. And you're trained at this, but you have met some people who you can probably debunk, but you probably is that right, John?
Oh yeah. I mean, when people tell me that they remember everything and they kind of go off on tangents that I've not heard before, I'm thinking, no, this is not typical. Plus, they don't seem upset or emotionally, you know, moved by it. Mm-hmm. So many people I dealt with were like, it'd be like a woman who had gotten raped and didn't want to talk about it. I mean, or a war veteran who doesn't want to talk about his battle scenes that were horrible and upsetting. You know, a lot of people, when they've really been through stuff, they're not eager and willing to talk. And so when you got someone that's like, oh, I'll tell you all about it and this and that, I'm thinking, doesn't seem very credible to be that eager to share. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think some years later, though, myself with combat in Vietnam, after so many years later, I'm more readily to talk about it, especially
sure.
with other veterans, and come out and talk about certain things. Now I laugh about it. I try to laugh it off because, you know, you want to shake that PTSD off you. But, you know, I run into people who might, a seed might be planted by a movie. Do you ask them that? Have they seen a movie
yes.
lately of these critters or whatever, John?
Yes. I have a questionnaire that I always have them fill out before I do anything. Mm-hmm. I ask about dream images or weird dreams. I ask about any paranormal type of, you know, things going on. I ask them about what books they've read, what names they might recognize, what movies they've seen related to the subject.
Right.
And, you know, it's really impressive when they hate science fiction. They've never read anything. They don't recognize any of the names. I go, okay, this person's going to be a good subject. But if they've read everything and more than most people and they recognize all the names, I'm thinking, But here's the thing. When I started to research, it was 1989. X-Files wasn't even on TV. The only thing that was on TV was maybe once a year, Unsolved Mysteries might have a UFO story.
Right.
That was it. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, you can tune into several channels and see all the UFO stuff you want. But back in 1989, there was nothing on TV. And most of my best research happened before anything really hit the public eye, like the little gray alien and all that stuff. By the time that became more of a well-known image, I was pretty much done with the bulk of my important research, and I actually didn't have much interest because I thought, oh, it's going to be so contaminated now. So many people know what they're supposed to look like and heard stories and, you know, but when I was doing research, there was hardly anything out there. Unless you'd read Missing Time or Intruders or Communion, which most people had not, but that would be the only thing that might give you some suggestion of creating such an experience in your head. And I also agree with you, PTSD wears off with time. As the years go by, it gets easier and it fades and it's easier to cope and talk about things. So that certainly makes sense.
The other thing, too, about being abducted and you got lost time, and I, 2 weeks after my second UFO with my friend, I dug out an implant, and there was a cut line in my testicle, left testicle. It was a laser line, and I pushed that implant out. It looked like a little M&M, and I showed it to my mom. She said, that's an ingrown, you know, hair or something. I said, no, Mom. I said, there was a cut line. There's a little red line. Now I know it as a laser line. And she said, just throw it away anyway. And she looked kind of puzzled when I told her there was a cut line for it. And I took it out. There was no blood accompanying that little pill-like looking thing. So she was a little stumped, but that's how I knew that was where the second shoe dropped, that I was on board that ship. And my buddy and I were both on board that ship. So I guess you look for little clues like that too, right, John?
That's right.
Detail.
And I would ask about any kind of odd, you know, injuries or marks on the body. I mean, just, you know, not really leading questions, but just kind of scanning their knowledge and their experiences and what they remember consciously, if anything. And, you know, just kind of do a sweep of their mindset and their belief in things, and just, you know, kind of do that before I even start working with them. Because sometimes I won't, you know, I'll say, oh, I don't think there's anything to this. I think you're just having this experience. And they seem fine with that. But usually when they come to me, they knew something was wrong and they want to find out what the heck's going on.
Mm-hmm. You know, Linda Moulton Hall, right?
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you a little story about that.
Okay.
First of all, she used to come to a conference in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. It was our UFO conference, and I spoke there a couple times, and she and I were together. And of course, she had the famous case of Cindy Daugherty that was in one of her books. Actually, it was in her TV special on cattle mutilations that won an Emmy. It ended that little news documentary with hypnosis session with Dr. Leo Sprinkle from Colorado, doing a hypnosis session with Cindy Daugherty, this mother who had been taken aboard a craft, saw a cow mutilated on the craft, and then saw her own daughter on a table on the craft and freaked out, thinking that her daughter was going to get carved up next.
Oh,
10 years went by. The daughter at the time had been like a 15-year-old. And thought her mom was crazy and didn't want to hear anything about it and moved away and had nothing to do with any of this stuff and never knew what her mother had come up with, never saw the special. Well, Linda Howe talked to the daughter 10 years later and asked her if she'd be willing to explore that night when they were all in a car and they saw a UFO. And she was older now, in her 30s, and she said, okay. Well, I guess it was a lot later, 20 years. And she says, okay, I know nothing happened, but sure, I'll do it for you because you worked with my mom. Well, I was the one that Linda knew that was close by. And so Linda brought her television crew to Springfield, Missouri, where I live. And funding her project was Robert Bigelow.
Ooh, wow.
And he showed up. And so he was there, she was there, her TV crew, and I was the hypnotist to finally explore what this daughter might remember. But what the daughter thought was a 15-minute session was 3 hours long, and all on film, and it was in Linda Howe's premiere of this show, Sightings, which was on TV. So the first show had me doing the hypnosis with Cindy Dory's daughter, Judy. I'm sorry, Judy was the mother and Cindy was the daughter. Well, make a long story short, Cindy also saw a calf being raised up to the craft in a blue beam of light. She also saw the calf being cut up and described the same parts Judy had. And then she remembers being on a table, being examined, and she can't move. But she's able to look over and see her mother looking at her from another room, screaming, "That's my daughter," just like the mother had remembered seeing the daughter on the table. So everything matched up. Daughter had no idea that she was matching that. And she had much more detail than the mother ever had. And after the session was over, she looked at us and she goes, "That was weird. Did any of that make sense?" And we all started laughing. It's like, oh, yeah.
Wow. You had Bigelow there in the room with you, right? Wow.
Yep. He was watching the whole thing and funding the project.
Yeah.
And he was so impressed with that. He got me, I already had met Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs at that point. I actually in 1989 I was invited to a conference in Aspen, Colorado. And guess who was there? Betty Hill.
Yeah.
Debbie from the Book Intruders, Travis Walton, Charlie Hickson,
yeah.
Dr. Leo Sprinkle, and I got to mingle with all of them in 1989, 1 year after I got into all this.
Well, you were walking in tall cotton, that's for sure. I mean, that's,
I was.
Yeah.
And Linda and I were, we were good buddies, for at least 10, 15 years, you know. One time my phone was making strange sounds and I heard a foreign broadcast on the line and then this guy from the Air Force, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base calls me and talks to me and wants to know about how I do hypnosis and what I think about this or that. And so I told Linda, I said, "Guess what? This guy called from Wright-Patterson and blah, blah, blah." And she just laughed and she goes, "They're doing a sound check for your phone, John, because they're going to be listening to a lot of calls you're making."
Oh, yeah. They listen.
He just laughed. He goes, "They won't hurt you. They want to know what you know because you're doing research that they can't do."
Yeah.
And she says, "They'll never hurt you, but they'll certainly be watching you closely." And, oh, yeah, I can tell you that.
I can tell you that we're being listened in on right now, probably, no doubt.
I hope so.
Yeah, you hope so. That's good. But, you know, Lynn Moulton Howell, you must have trained her, John, because she interviewed me some 10, 12 years ago. And she talked to me about 45 minutes, and she's a journalist, and so am I. So I know a little bit of the journalist tricks, but she interviewing me and she would ask me the same question in a different manner, like psychology, like you used. And so you must have trained her well. So
she saw how I worked, and I used the same trick questions on Cindy Daugherty.
Yes.
And it worked. I mean, it was beautiful. It worked like a dream.
Yeah.
Afterwards, that was such a great session.
Yeah. Afterwards, I asked her, I said, well, Linda, what'd you think? She said, you're real. She said, you're for real. I said, well, thanks. That makes me feel better that, you know, I'm not crazy. You know, she's, oh, no, you're not crazy. She said, you're just going to have a hard time fitting in because you've had so many experiences. Now, let me ask you this. Is there a rhyme or reason why certain people are chosen to be abducted or even messed with, John?
No, that question's come up many times. We've checked heritage and blood type and personalities and all sorts of things, and we never did find a common denominator. However, we believe that a person is randomly picked to start with, and then that lineage is followed for a number of generations. Because it's interesting, Judy Daugherty, her mother had some kind of weird experiences. Then Judy's daughter, Cindy, had experiences. And then I worked with Cindy and even her daughter, Cindy's daughter, who had visits by some strange beings. So we tracked four generations in that one family. And I found many times that as far as we could go, we found another generation in that same family that had experiences.
Right. A lot of my family have had experiences. I'm going to interview my mom. She's 96. And she,
you kinda, better hurry.
Yeah, I better hurry. I haven't had time. I told her I'm going to get to it, but she's had some health issues in the last couple of years, but she knows about ET experiences inside her house. And so when her and I talk, my other brothers look at me and say, why does she talk to you about that stuff? I said, because she knows I'm an experiencer too, that I've seen things that she's seen. And so that's why I ask you if it traveled in the bloodline. And we do have a little bit of Native American Indian blood in us. But they also said the Native American Indians were followed, you know, through their DNA line. Is that true, John? I mean, do they take
well,
it from that?
It's true, because if you're talking about family lineage, of course the DNA and the heritage is going to be similar. But I think that a scientist can do a longitudinal study, which means they're going to track something over a number of generations. Mm-hmm. And the aliens are doing exactly that. I mean, almost any time I can, I find that there's at least one or two more levels in the family to that experience. Now, they may not have wanted to talk about it or may not have thought there was anything, but a lot of times I'll get a lot of clues and I may not be able to prove it, but it's highly suspicious when they say, oh yeah, I've seen those lights all my childhood, but I don't talk about it. And it's like, okay.
Yeah. I want to ask you, there's several different ways that people are abducted. They can be abducted by bedside. I had a bedside abduction. I mean, they do their getting, collecting samples like semen, blood, or they take your frequencies, read your mind, record what you know and how you learn. The other one is they take you up in the ship. They beam you up. Mm-hmm. Mostly, I think women usually are taken aboard ship because what they do and take eggs from them is a little bit tougher procedure. So it takes them, they have to take them to their labs on board ship. Am I crazy by saying that, John?
Well, I think they certainly do take them up there, but I've probably known just as many men that went up, and often they had sperm samples taken or other kinds of samples taken. So I never thought of it as mostly women. You know, by the way, I remembered something else psychological, which was interesting. I had at least two or three cases where they had a phobia of falling up.
Oh, yes. Or flying.
Now, how in the world do you develop a phobia of falling up? I mean, this guy had to like hang on to the fence when he go outside, make sure he was holding on to something when he go to his car, so that he wouldn't go up in the air. And he never could understand why was he doing that. It made no sense. Well, of course, when he realized his experiences, it all made sense then, because he had felt his feet leave the ground. And that's a very upsetting sensation when you feel a blue beam of light and your feet are leaving the ground and you have no control anymore.
Yeah, that's a tractor beam, yeah.
Yeah, and it left them with a phobia, a natural human reaction to something very bizarre and scary, and that they no longer were with feet on the ground and they were flying up in the air.
Yeah.
But you know, that it was just so interesting. I had another girl who was terrified of baby dolls and wouldn't let her daughter even have dolls. And she never understood why. Well, it just so happened by accident when we were exploring a session, she saw the hybrid children in a room. And you know how dolls often have a really freaky, almost scary look on their faces.
I don't like dolls too well. No.
Exactly. No. Well, when she saw the hybrid children, she said, "That's my doll." And then she realized that's where she had been all upset after seeing those hybrid children. And then she couldn't see or play with anything that reminded her of those strange looking hybrid children, which her dolls often look kind of strange too. And so she would freak out, and she didn't want her daughter to have any either. And so it's another phobia,
right,
of something based on a real upsetting experience.
How about dreams of flying? They say that has something to do with the being abducted, doctor.
Yeah.
I can call you doctor, Dr. John. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people call me Dr. John, but I'm still a therapist. well, dreams of flying are very common dreams. It has to do more with confidence and self-esteem and feeling on top of things, literally. It doesn't usually mean that they had a UFO experience. Usually not. Now, if their emotions are upset or traumatized because of that, that's a little different.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's hard to make a general comment about that, but, you know, emotions are the key here. And, you know, and I've met people who had experiences that didn't upset them, just like when we're talking about the movie theater and people come out with different reactions, where they had memories and they remembered almost everything and they weren't traumatized or upset. They were very curious and excited, and they could talk about it. There was no work to do with them. And so I don't usually have those kind of clients because they're not upset. They're not emotionally needing the work. They're fine. They're dandy. They remember stuff and they go on their way. They don't need me.
Right. I'm asking you questions because I know there's people out there who think they've been abducted. I've had people write me and ask me, "Do you think I've been abducted?" And they'll give me a few details. And I said, it's hard to say without talking to you at length and getting details. But
right.
There's a third way of abduction in which I've experienced, and I'm pretty sure it happened 6 years in a row on the same, almost on the same day, August 11th through the 13th every year. And I woke up about 3 o'clock in the morning. My body was completely frozen. My hands were across me like I was laying in a coffin, and I was shaking the whole bed. My body was just shaking violently cold. And my wife, who usually hears the cell phone drop on the carpet, she didn't wake up. She was dead asleep. And I said,
well, they can keep her asleep. They keep her people asleep.
What is that freezing factor? What happens when you get frozen? You're not thinking either. Nothing's on your mind. You're not really thinking about dying or anything. It's just you're blank. Yeah.
Well, was it more of a cold feeling or being immobilized?
I wasn't immobilized because I got up and went to the bathroom, and I was still shaking when I was in the bathroom. I sat down to take a leak because when you're really cold, you
right.
take a leak. The room was 72 degrees. It was hot. And the air conditioner's on. I had a blanket on. So I told the doctor that. And that when I told the doctor it happened every year, the same day, that's when she raised her eyes. She said, "I don't know what to tell you." You know, she said, "Your blood work don't show that." But I was deeply frozen. I mean, really, I felt my arms and they was ice cold. And I was able to get up and pee. And I went back to bed and I covered up and I went to sleep real quick because I was exhausted. So I don't know what happened during those times.
Do you remember what the temperature was outside?
Yeah, it was about 74, 75. It was August 11th, so it was hot. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have not heard that hardly ever. And, you know, it's kind of hard to assume it's a UFO experience. I would say probably not, unless you had other details to go with that.
Well, but I never sleep on my back with my arms across my stomach, like, you know, laying in a casket. I never sleep like that.
You did that time.
Yeah, I did. I, six times in a row, actually, and I was frozen. My wife didn't wake up. So apparently she was knocked out, but she wakes up with this big head and everything. She'll wake up. But that's one area where I keep thinking, well, they took my essence, my energy, and my consciousness and took it to another dimension and then left my body there, you know, without the energy, and I got cold. I don't know. That's thinking deep.
I have had several abductions that were like out-of-body experience abductions. Mm-hmm. They didn't report being cold or anything like that upon return, but I have a couple, very few, but just a couple that the wife could say the body was there, the person was there, they never left the bed, and yet she couldn't wake him up or anything, and he recalls being somewhere else, you know, at the time, and also feeling like he wasn't really there in his physical body.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, I know that certainly I've done research on near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences, and I know that when spirits are present, that the room can get very cold, you can get very cold if you're in contact with a paranormal energy, mm-hmm. mainly because they drain the energy out of the air. And so they'll take literally the heat out of the air or perhaps out of you at those times. So maybe you had a ghost, not an ET.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. Something really paranormal happened. Now, you talk about near-death, research. And could you tell us, John, some really interesting stories of near-death experiences?
How many hours you got?
we got about 35 minutes or whatever.
I'm just kidding.
Okay.
Well, again, I started learning about those probably in high school, and I was, again, amazed that people were reporting something beyond death. Raymond Booty's book, Life After Life, was a classic, and I read that as a young, I think in college, person. And then when I started seeing patients for therapy, well, they always tell me the things they don't tell anybody else. And so I started getting all these stories about near-death experiences and visions. And I started to find that they were pretty interesting, because I remember one professional lady, she was so matter-of-fact and so smart, and you would just never doubt anything she said. And I asked her, I said, because I didn't know, I said, well, was it misty or dreamlike when you were seeing what you thought was heaven? She goes, oh, no, it was more real than anything I've ever known. It was more clear, more sharp, more colorful, more vivid. And I was surprised, because I didn't expect to hear that. Mm-hmm. And this, she described this really bright green grass and beautiful big flowers. And I said, well, what were you like? And I didn't know what she would say. She goes, well, I was like a little cloud of energy that could just go anywhere I think. And it just zip around and be anywhere I think. Well, so I just kind of tucked that away, like, well, that was different. That was interesting.
Right.
I found out, after now studying hundreds of reports and talking to many other people firsthand, everything she said was classic, that everyone reports the same kind of stuff. And so what I did in my book called The Intense Reality of Eternity, which is a way of saying, you better believe there's something there. The Intense Reality of Eternity. And in that book, what I did, I didn't want to present 200 different near-death stories, because you've seen books that do stuff like that. What I did is I went through 200 to 300 reports from all around the world, all different religions and backgrounds, and atheists and blind people who've never seen anything, and just all these different reports. And what I did, instead of telling 200 stories, I took the best quotes and testimonies from each of their experiences and put them together
mm-hmm.
into one journey, because everyone's got like a piece of the puzzle and they overlap.
Right.
And so by the time you put all those pieces together, you have one very detailed, comprehensive journey. And anyone who's read that book has just gone, wow, because if they aren't sure about this detail, after they've heard 10 more people say the same kind of thing in their own way, they're starting to think, oh, there must be something to what they're seeing or what they're feeling or what they're experiencing. And that was just so powerful. I didn't know until I started adding it all together how powerful it was going to be.
Yeah, that was, it was The Intense Reality of Eternity. It was written in 2020. Yeah.
Right, right. Right during the pandemic.
Yeah, that's a good time. Now, you've heard nice stories, beautiful stories. What about bad stories? Like some people say they see the devil or they see fire, John. Yep. Are there bad dreams?
Or near death? And it's funny because some of the atheists who thought science could explain everything and nobody has any kind of after death or afterlife experience, it's all a bunch of chemistry and neuroplastic explosions in the brain, all sorts of things that they're claiming. Oh my gosh, when they came back from their experiences, they were saying that is the most real thing ever. Mm-hmm. And one of the authors is Eben Alexander. You may have heard his name. He wrote Proof of Life or Proof of Heaven. I think that's what it was, Proof of Heaven. He was a scientist, an atheist, and oh boy, he came back saying there's nothing more real than the afterlife. And he had glimpses of heaven and hell. But to make a long story short, all his glimpses of hell, which was basically for people who reject God and don't believe in God, because how are they going to go to God's heaven if they don't believe in him or reject him?
Right.
It's like saying you're going to go to this guy's house that you don't even know, but you're just going to move in and he won't mind. Even though you don't know him and he doesn't know you. Well, if you don't know God and you don't know anything about him and you reject him and you curse him and you deny him, heaven's kind of where you're going to end up. I mean, not heaven, hell, sorry. Yeah. That's a long story, but he saw darkness and people screaming and all sorts of hideous beasts and creatures. And it was just scary, but he came back saying, you better believe it. You better not go to bed tonight unless you really consider this seriously. And you better start believing right now. It was such a dramatic shift in his whole career, his mindset, his fellow scientists. He says, yes, you can have science, but you can also have this too. The supernatural world is very real. And he says, there's nothing more real than that.
Right. You have another book. It's Show Me God, I Am. That was in 2022. I guess that's a follow-up of that other book that you just talked about. Now, there is a God. What do you think God is all about, John? What is God?
Well, I think he's the highest form of energy. I think he's the creator of everything. I think, you know, what we've not only been told, but what people have experienced when they, you know, see glimpses of heaven. They come back, and by the way, not a single atheist that ever experiences an afterlife experience has come back as an atheist. They are forever changed once they experience what they come across. And that's the other thing about the hell visions, that not just Eben Alexander, but many people have had those same experiences and describe it exactly the same way. For example, they don't just say it's dark and black. They say the darkness is alive. They all say that. They say it's like a living evil. You can feel it. You can smell it. And I don't hear people talk like that about darkness, but they do. Is what they experience. So that's the thing I tried to do in the book, was show how many similarities are in people's experiences. And that's powerful, because if it was imagination or delusion or hallucination, it'd go 1,000 different directions. But since if it's a reality, you're going to have a convergence of details all coming together and sounding extremely alike. Even if they're bizarre, they still will show up and match each other and be there, kind of like a UFO abduction experience. Mm-hmm. And the details might be bizarre, but if you got 1,000 people reporting the same thing, it's going to suggest there's a reality to it.
Right. You mentioned spirits a while ago, that be in a room and everything be cold. Now, these, I heard that the spirits come back and visit you before you die, near death experiences. Do they have relatives that come in the room and they talk to them, John?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that happens. And in fact, I've talked to a number of people that have gone through that in person. They say, I was with Dad. And all of a sudden he looked over in the corner room. He goes, well, there's Grandma. And everyone looks over the corner. Of course, they don't see anything. He goes, Grandma's here. And then maybe 30 minutes later, he dies.
Yeah, right.
But that happens quite often. It's very, very common that they'll see a, if not a relative, it might be an angelic figure or something else that they'll see, or they'll see a glimpse into heaven already, and they'll just have this big smile on their face, and their eyes will get all, you know, teary-eyed and just excited, and then they close their eyes and they go.
Yeah, I've heard stories. I just saw a documentary or something where people that are dying, and they've been laying there half comatose, all of a sudden they set up and they look at everybody and they say hi to certain people and they lay back down and they die. Has that happened that you
know? Oh, yeah. A lot. Yes, a lot. Yeah. In fact, a lot of times they report a burst of energy right before they die. Like they may even get up and walk around the room and everyone thinks, oh, they're getting better. Then they lay back down and they go.
I also heard stories, and my mom told me this story, that she had a real lucid dream one night, and her mom, my grandma, of course, passed away in the mid-70s, and she said that there was a little gray fella, like an E.T., that was had my grandma's hand and walking her towards my mom in the dream. And she looked at my grandma, she looked at her, and they didn't say anything, but they just looked at each other, and there's this little gray guy. What does that mean? What is it? An ET walking a spirit person, John?
I've never heard that.
Really? Yeah. That's what she told
me. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases, and I've never heard that one.
Yeah. She said that and to this day, you know, she'll still tell me that same story. She said there's a little thing that was walking her by her hand and bringing her up close to my mom as she was in that lucid dream.
Well, I do have a theory about that, though.
Yeah.
Because one abductee I worked with actually asked them, are you gods? Are you like rulers of the universe? And the alien, if an alien could laugh, I guess he kind of laughed and told her, he says, oh, no, there is a supreme being, but we're just another race under the supreme being.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking if grandma or whoever had a special link to an ET, perhaps they were together.
So I guess ETs have souls also, apparently. They're biological like us. Most of them are. Some of them are mechanical. Maybe the small little grays are.
Yeah. Linda Moulton Howe thought that a lot of the little ones she called worker bees, who might be like androids or cloned biological robots or something like that, because they all look alike and seem to be just doing the mechanical work. But so I don't know if they have souls, but certainly the ones that look into your eyes and seem familiar, like you've known them all your life, yeah, they probably have some kind of soul.
Yeah, and you have another book here. It's Be Not Afraid to Follow the Footprints from Heaven. I guess that you just kind of talked a little bit about that, but I'm just trying to get your books out there to people that might be interested in what you're talking about and look on.
Well, what that title means is don't be afraid to look at the evidence that God might be real.
Okay, good.
So when I say the footprints, I'm talking about the miracles, the artifacts, the different things that we can actually touch and look at and examine. I'll just give you one quick one that even most religious people don't know about. And there was a whole series of miracles in this case. First of all, this little deaf mute girl suddenly could talk and speak because they had seen, quote, the Virgin Mary in a cave in Colombia. Well, her mother didn't know what to believe, but then her daughter disappeared one day, summoned by that entity. And the mother goes and finds her in the cave, and she sees the Virgin Mary too. So then they keep it a secret because they know nobody's going to believe them. Well, unfortunately, at 4 years old, the little girl gets very ill and dies. Well, the mother is so upset, and the whole village sees the dead body and the lifeless girl, and mother sneaks her off to that cave and prays and prays and prays for Jesus to bring her little girl back to life. The little girl jumps up full of energy, skips and dances, and goes back. Well, that didn't go over too well when they got back to the village. Because, wait a minute, she was dead. How is that possible?
Huh?
And this is in 1754 in Columbia. And to make a long story short, they all want to see this cave now. We want to see this cave. We want to know what's going on here. So they go back to the cave, and when they go in the cave and they shine their lights around, on the wall of the cave is like a 20-foot high by about 10 feet wide, elaborate, detailed, colorful painting of the Virgin Mary, the baby Jesus, and two saints, Saint Dominic and Saint Francis, who were the two religious orders in Colombia at that time. And so you got to think, first of all, wait a minute, who can paint in the darkness of a cave overnight and create such an elaborate painting? And secondly, when they brought scientists in and geologists and all that, they found out that there was no paint. There was no stain, no dye, no ink, no substance whatsoever to make the painting. When they chipped away at the painting, it was the same color underneath and underneath and underneath, no matter how much they chipped away at the wall. So they had one of the geologists from Germany to drill a core sample into the wall. That painting image, which is not a painting, went 2 feet deep into the cave wall.
Oh, wow. I've never heard of that story. That's unique.
But that's the thing. That's out there. It's really, you can go visit it today. They built a church around it. It's a huge thing in Colombia. I had a friend who was from there, and she says, "Oh, yeah." And she pulled out her cell phone and showed me pictures of it. it's one of those stories that scientists cannot explain it. They say it's the natural color of the rock. That was their conclusion. And the image goes 2 feet deep into the wall. And this is after the little girl's resurrection and her healing from being deaf mute and all the stuff that they were keeping secret. And they treasure that. They have that image protected inside the church. It's behind the altar now, and you can go see it. It's right there.
That's one
example of the kind of stuff I had in my book, these gems that I found that are out there, that are unbelievable. Science has studied them, all sorts of different things. And so I just had fun collecting as many strange oddities and unusual things that science has taken a look at. And that's why I said, don't be afraid to examine the footprints from heaven, because there's some very real unexplained things there.
Oh, I believe in miracles, and I believe in angels too. I wrote a book about angels, and you mentioned angels a while ago, being around people that are dying. What do you think an angel is? I know that they're supposed to be eons old, and they're older than us humans, probably, if you go back to the religious, the biblical.
Right. Well, they're not people. They're spiritual beings that are neither male or female. Right. They often kind of look androgynous, kind of a mix between. Mm-hmm. Some paintings actually show that, where they kind of have long curly hair, but they're not exactly men or women. They're just kind of in between. And they basically have many functions to serve God. And this, again, is in my book, where I show the different roles of angels, and I have different encounters, different experiences, different ways to show that. One of my favorite stories is when this two brothers were driving home to their mother's house for Thanksgiving in Indiana, and there's a horrible blizzard and sub-zero temperatures, and their car broke down and they're on the side of the road. And, you know, it's one of those horrible scenarios where they're going to die. If they get out of the car, it's like minus 60 degree wind chill, and it's just miserable, and they're just desperate. Well, she saw the weather report, so she starts praying really hard and praying and praying and praying. All of a sudden, this tow truck pulls up in front of them. Big burly guy jumps out and comes up to the window and says, "Hey, you guys look like you could use some help." And they go, "Oh, thank you. We sure could." And so they told them where their mother's address was, and because it was a Sunday and there was no shop open, so he was going to tow them to their mother's house. Mm-hmm. So they're so excited. He hooks up the chains to the bumper and everything, and tows them out and tows them, you know, about 15 miles or whatever to where the mother's house was.
Right.
Pulls right up in front of the house and starts to work with unhooking the chains. And they run up to the door and say, Mom, we made it. And she goes, "Oh, thank God, my prayers were answered." She goes, "Yeah, that big guy with the tow truck saved us." And she goes, "What guy?" And they turn around and look, there's no tow truck. There's no guy at all. There's nothing there.
Yeah.
And they're going, well, wait a minute, he was just here. We both talked to him and saw him. And so they run out there on the road because, oh, there'll be tracks from his truck and his footprints. Nothing. I said, well, we couldn't have gotten here. Our car's dead. There's no way we could have gotten here. She says, I saw your car come up the road. There was no tow truck. It was coming up the road all by itself. And they look at each other and they go, there's no way. It's dead as a doornail. You know, it's just.
Yeah, I've heard.
But I love that story because there is absolutely no way they could have gotten there. And she had, you know, prayed and prayed and prayed for help. And apparently an angelic presence did so.
Yeah. I've heard stories like that of people seeing other people helping others and then they disappear and they're gone. John, you got your last book here in 2024, The Unexpected Journey. Now, that is Journey Through Life. Is that what you're talking about, John?
Now it's a journey. It's a novel I wrote, and it's the very first one that I've ever tried to write, but it's based on so much of this, you know, unusual, miraculous stuff that I've uncovered.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a tough police detective who gets sidelined with an injury and he can't be on the streets anymore. And he's really pissed off and he's getting depressed because he has to sit at a desk and watch everybody else go out. Well, his best friend from college gets in touch with him and says, hey, you ought to come work with me over in Italy. And so the Vatican has this new miraculous claims investigation unit. And we could use a tough old bird like you, a tough old detective, to help us explore some of these claims that people make out there. And he says, well, that sounds pretty interesting. So basically, to make a long story short, he and the team from there start to investigate some of these miraculous things, which I just described one. In fact, he actually goes to the cave with the image.
Yeah.
You know, I'd make it a different country and change some of the outside details, but the inner details are exactly the same as the real miracle. But I have him be there and explore it and try to explain it. And so his journey, his unexpected journey, is finding all these things in the world that he really can't explain and how it transforms him in a very believable, natural process throughout the book. So I had a lot of fun writing it. It was really a journey of learning and being exposed to things. And what's really cool at the back of the book, then I say, okay, everything in the book that was believable was fiction. Everything that seemed impossible and supernatural was factually real. And if you don't believe me, read on. And I have 30 pages of describing the actual real miracles that the novel is based on.
That sounds very interesting. You write some good books. Hey, I got to ask you a question. I mean, since, like the comment I made, you've been walking in tall cotton, you know, you met these big shots. I mean, people like, you know, Dr. Jacob and also Bigelow and, you know, all these people. Could you tell us, you got to know these people. Could you tell us secrets about these people that maybe people haven't heard? Can you tell on them right now, John?
Well, we're all a bunch of guys just trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
And we would share stories and details we hadn't told publicly, and then we'd be amazed if we'd come up with the same details ourselves, even though we hadn't shared it publicly. So we were like investigators, detectives, trying to figure everything out and sharing our details. When I was at the MIT's famous abduction study conference in 1992 at MIT, I was actually on the panel to organize it and presented several talks. I asked the audience at one point, because they're like, oh, at least maybe 500 investigators from all around the world out there, you know, researchers. And I just polled them. I said, how many of you have experienced this? And like, say, maybe reptilian aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, David Jacobs was really kind of uneasy because he thinks that's some kind of screen image. And he turned around and looked, and 2/3 of the audience had their hands up. And when you got like 500 researchers, and each one of them could have at least 100 cases, you're talking about 5,000 cases or 50,000 cases. I mean, you're talking about a huge sample to ask those questions of. So I had fun doing that. And I enjoyed getting to know Bob Bigelow. He had me at his on Vancouver Island, we were doing a case up there. He liked the way I did the hypnosis and the trick questions, and so he called me in on a few cases. George Knapp did too, you know. We were sitting there and we were just discussing life and all these mysteries and just kind of reviewing it all. I had no idea he'd go on to do even bigger things, but I will say when I got a chance to present to his science panel, the NIDS, National Institute for Discovery Science, that's NIDS,
yeah,
in Las Vegas. He wanted me to bring some of the panel up to speed on UFO abductions and stuff because they hadn't really had a lecture on it. So I was doing my part in that. In the audience, not all of them would give their names, but there were some amazing people there. Jacques Vallée.
Yeah.
Ian Stevenson, who did the reincarnation studies in India.
Yeah.
Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell.
Really? Yeah.
Apollo 17 astronaut Harrison Schmitt, the geologist. People from Los Alamos Labs. There was just some really big names from different organizations, and Hal Puthoff, the astrophysicist. I mean, it just went on and on. There's really a who's who of famous scientists from different places. And here I was giving them a lecture, and I was just like, are you kidding me? Well, Edgar Mitchell came up to me afterwards, and he goes, what do you think of leprechauns and elves? And I said, well, I think they might be the same little people, just called by different names. And he looked at me and grinned real big and shook his head a big yes, like, I believe that too.
That is amazing. You're an amazing person. I mean, as far as ufology is concerned, you're there in the cream of the crop. I mean, you've been around the big hitters. Now, some of the things, I know there's sometimes like Bigelow, has he ever made a statement about what he believes and what he has seen, John?
Oh, he's 100% into all this stuff, and that's why he wanted to fund research. He had the Skinwalker Ranch, you know, and he bought that so that his science team that I just met with could go there or have representatives go there and do research science on what was going on there, all the paranormal stuff. He was all about finding answers. He was really open-minded. He was really interested in what all we could learn. And he felt like the whole field needed funds to make it happen. He funded many of us in different projects like Linda House project, which led to that whole series of sightings, you know, that show sighting that was probably on for 10 years in the 90s. But he wanted to make things happen. He wanted to help the field grow and develop.
Why did he get out of Skinwalker Ranch? Why did he sell it, John?
I think there was a point where they had done maybe as much as they wanted to. I mean, because you had to have these scientists be willing to go there and keep working on it. And he had it for quite a few years. And he told me a few real interesting stories from there as well. I never got to actually go there, but George Knapp and Bigelow took me to the front gate of Area 51. No, we did not go in, but the actual base was probably 15 miles away from the front gate. Not at all close to where we were, but that was fun. I mean, when I look back and think, yeah, I was there with Bigelow, and I also was with Stanton Friedman and at Roswell, and another on the plains of San Augustine where he suspected a second disc had crashed. And we had some witnesses and evidence to that. And Bigelow and me and Stanton Friedman and Don Berliner. And then one of the witnesses were there. So I look back on all that stuff and I go, I really was riding the wave along with some big names. And at a time when UFO abduction stuff was brand new to the public, and here I was, one of the top people researching it. I was just doing what I do, but since nobody else is doing it, that suddenly everybody wants to hear what you find.
Right. What about 1954, Eisenhower meeting ETs there? Do you believe that, John?
Probably. I think there's enough evidence and the things he did after that. And even his own granddaughter has said that that happened. And, you know, there's other things that point to something like that happening. MJ-12, you know, was formed right around that time, which was a panel to especially kind of oversee. It's interesting that CIA was formed right after Roswell.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that look coincidental. But one of my favorite people, too, I didn't mention yet, Leonard Stringfield. He was a legend. He was actually in World War II, was over, and his group was going to be involved in Japan, I guess with a surrender or something. But he had the Foo Fighters. He saw them firsthand, the luminous discs and lights that were intercepting the fighter planes. So he had that firsthand. And so he got assigned a position in the military to collect UFO reports. So he did that for a while. But when he came out of the military, he continued to collect UFO reports. And the military says, oh, we don't know what he was doing now. He didn't do anything like that for us. Of course, they're going to deny he did anything like that for them. But right. He was a solid guy. And since he was such a solid, reliable guy, he continued to get military witnesses. He told me in an interview I did with him the year before he died, In 1994 is when he died. The year before, I did an interview, and he told me, in short, that there were over 650 independent military witnesses coming to him with things they'd seen. Maybe somebody was a freezer repairman in an underground base and saw aliens laying on a table. At that same base, another independent person comes and said they were fixing a furnace and saw bodies on the table. Another person says they were transporting and loaded some youth-sized coffins into that area. I mean, by the time you put all those pieces together, it all corroborates. And he said that he estimated there were at least 30 crashed discs and at least 30 bodies recovered from all the witnesses and military people that came to him that he knew would trust him and not reveal their identities. But they wanted to share what they had experienced because they knew it was strange. It was weird. It was not normal.
Right. And we must be linked up, John, because I was thinking of the same thing because you mentioned 30 discs earlier. And then David Gersh, I guess Gersh, he's with this new disclosure team, and he was a whistleblower. He said there was 9 discs, and there was something like 3 or 4 bodies that they had. And now you're saying 30 discs and maybe 30 bodies. That's more close to right or correct, John?
Well, according to Leonard, and he was not one to exaggerate. He was nuts and bolts, solid, down to earth, gutsy guy. You know, ex-military. That's why people came to him, because they knew that, first of all, they could trust him. Mm-hmm. He wasn't going to reveal their names or anything, but he also was going to do the right thing with the data. He was and do the right thing with it, and they knew that about him. So that's why for years and years they kept coming to him and telling him things. Right. I think he even had the president of Mexico tell him one case. I mean, he had a lot of really good witnesses. And talking to him was just amazing. I realized I've got that interview on video. I really should put it somewhere.
You're an amazing person. You're much deeper than what I thought. I mean, my goodness, John, you're in there with the biggies. Let's go into disclosure. We'll close out with disclosure. What do you feel about disclosure? And do you think it ever will really happen, John?
We all wish it would, but as we saw recently, even when they got close to treating it seriously, then they backpedaled and said they didn't find anything significant. The bodies at Roswell were crash dummies, which was an old, old excuse that was long outdated and laughed at
right.
20 years ago. It's like they actually brought that up and tried to pass that off again. Well, I know that the mortician in Roswell got a request for several youth-sized coffins. And I don't remember when we would bury crash dummies in youth-sized coffins. Yeah. I don't know why we would need to bury crash dummies.
Yeah, you think about these things, use common sense when it comes to that. I guess the government, they don't want us to have common sense. They don't want us to use it. They actually, I think they're trying to slow down this disclosure now. I think they went too far. And
I think so too.
And the people that are in charge of the world banks and the rich people are saying, stop, we don't want no more of this. So the government is probably stopping, and they don't want us to talk about it too much either, John. You know,
someone pulled the plug on it. And I was hopeful that this was going to be their effort to slowly leak more information out over a period of time. But when they backpedaled, it's like someone pulled the plug and said, nope, we're not doing this. And I thought, well, it'll be another 30 years now. Yeah. And the aliens will be living on planet with us before they admit.
What did you think about Louis Alessandro and the Blink 52 guy, I guess, and also the ex-defense secretary? They had a team going. I forget his name. There's three or four of them that had a core group going for disclosure. Do you think they were very legit? Did they try hard enough, John?
Hey, a lot of people have tried really hard, and it's a stone wall. It really is. I mean, even presidents don't know that much. And the reason is people in the NSA will tell you that, well, they're only around for maybe 4 years, whereas the NSA people working on it have been around for 30 plus years. So why would they tell a temporary person anything? You know, in the movie Independence Day, where the president was kind of like a Bill Clinton.
Right.
And they really did a good job of saying, well, he said, well, if there was anything going on, I'd know about. And the guy goes, well, not necessarily.
What about the story about Eisenhower? He wanted to know what was going on at Area 51. And he said he had an army base there in Colorado. And he said, if you don't tell me what's going on there, he said, I'm going to send the military down. We're going to come through the gates, and we're going to find out what's going on. So they finally got together and said, okay, why don't you send us about three or four of your scientific representatives, and we'll show them around. And they finally showed him what was going on. And Eisenhower actually found out what was going on there at the time. But it's
I think that's true.
Now. Yeah. You think that's true, John?
Yeah, I do. I think that's probably true. Yeah. Like I heard recently, his granddaughter confirmed a lot of those things.
Yeah.
So
yeah, she did.
Yeah.
We're in our last minutes. Could you tell people where we can get a hold of you on the internet, John Carpenter, and where we can get your books?
Well, all of my books are on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kindle, if you like digital books. I'll just say the titles, and don't look up John Carpenter, because you're going to get the movie director who did all the scary movies. If you look up my name, make sure it's John S. Carpenter. That pulls them up better. But I would, if you want to write these down real quick, the first one was Be Not Afraid to Follow the Footprints from Heaven. The second book is He Is Alive, Science Finds Jesus. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. The third one is The Intense Reality of Eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth one in this recent bunch is Show Me God, I Am. And that's just real quick, that's a debate between a teacher and a whole bunch of defiant students that think they know everything. And it's a wonderful dialogue. The whole book is classroom debates over different religious topics, and the teacher is presenting all sorts of evidence, and the students are coming up with all the things you hear people say these days about what it isn't or it can't be or what it really is. And
right.
So it's a nice debate book. And then my last one, the novel, will come out in about a month. So, and it's The Unexpected Journey.
Okay.
My psychology book that I put out really is more for professionals in the field. So I don't really advertise that for the general public, because it's not exactly for them. But
it just shows that you have a well-rounded background with all this, and psychology and ufology kind of mixes together a little bit.
MUFON was so excited. They were so glad to have a professional to investigate things, because often they just had interested people. But back then, if you had a degree of any kind, they were thrilled, because they knew they had some professional credentials behind the work.
Right. Kathy Martin is a sociologist, and she did that work with them. And you probably worked with her, or you worked compartmentalized with her, probably.
I was going to do some hypnosis sessions with her, but her living like 2,000 miles away from me. It was a little hard to get together, but she told me some details from her stuff. And of course, I was glad to meet Betty Hill, her aunt, you know, after all that. And she and I talked, oh, sometime here in the last year. We keep in touch.
Yeah, she's a nice person. I've had three or four interviews with her, and I met her in person at Eureka Springs. I went there several times back in 2009 through 2012. I went there, and I met a lot of people there, and it was interesting. And I might have even seen you, and I don't remember it.
Well, I stopped going there probably about 2000.
Oh, really?
I've gone every year since 88. So,
okay.
Yeah, but
I went the later years. Well, not later.
Yeah.
It's changed a little bit now. They have a little bit of crossover with the psychic stuff and the phenomena of consciousness and this thing. Consciousness goes along with your studies also, I guess, John.
Oh, let me tell you real quick a quote that John Mack, the psychiatrist from Harvard, said to me, because we got to know each other real well. In fact, he wrote me a letter asking me about abductions before he got into the work. I still have that letter where he wrote me asking my opinion, which I think was funny now, but we were at dinner in Boston with a research group, and he was sitting next to me, and he leaned over, since we're both in the psychiatric field, and he says, you know, John, if these people were really crazy, there's no way we'd be spending our free time doing this. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, in the future, I'm going to draw on you as a consultant in case I need to talk to somebody or people want to talk to you or whatever. You got so much information, academia, the psychology, the ufology, and you know all these big shots. My goodness, I'm shocked. This you impressed me a lot. I didn't know you had that big background of all these people that you worked with and know. I'm very impressed, John. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I feel fortunate that I got in when I did and got to know the people that I did. And I'm humble and I like to kind of keep a low profile, but I love all the experiences I got to have and the travels and people I met. And, you know, I knew I wouldn't have any trouble telling you stuff tonight.
Oh yeah, I know. I know that too. I just saw your credentials, your resume you sent me. I said, no, we're not going to have a problem. I said that at the beginning of the show. And I want to thank everybody for listening in and watching this show. It's going to be released probably tomorrow. It's pre-recorded, but we'll have a comment section there in case you ever want to write to John or whatever. We'll see how that goes. But you've been listening to Strange Reality, Dave Emmons and John S. Carpenter. We'll go John S. Carpenter. The other Carpenter is a big movie producer. And that's what I was going to ask you about a while ago. I said, are you the John Carpenter? No, you're the John S. Carpenter. But you tell you what, I bet you have just as much knowledge as he does and more.
Probably more.
Oh, there you go. Thank you so much, John S. Carpenter. And this is Dave Emmons signing off.